Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C. Sierra Leone's President Julius Maada Bio signs into law the Gender Equality and Women's Empowerment Act.
This happened today is historic in more ways than one. In fact, it comes fast on the heels of other reforms, frame-breaking reforms that have happened in this country under the leadership of President Julius Maada Bio.
Nigerian groups condemned the attack on Ikenga Ugochinyere, the spokesperson for the opposition coalition of United Political Parties, or CUPP.
Ugochinyere has been one of the very strong voices in opposition who has spoken out against things that are not going right. And it is sad that this kind of incident will happen at his country home.
And Malawi's justice minister says President Lazarus Chakwera is demonstrating commitment to the fight against graft and mismanagement.
We have done a lot of things to show our commitment to fight against corruption in this country. Previously, the Anti-Corruption Bureau, which is the institution mandated here to deal with matters of corruption, had been starved without funding. The funding was not being provided.
Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Sierra Leone, President Julius Maada Bio signed into law the Gender Equality and Women's Act on Thursday. Officials say the law seeks to increase women in positions of power in the West African country. The move is being hailed by civil society groups as a boost to the effort to empower women in Sierra Leone. The law, they contend, will help end the exclusion of women from politics and business. The new law requires that all private and public institutions ensure that at least 30% of their employees are women. It also requires at least that over a third of all elective offices are held by women. The rule comes as First Lady Madam Fatima Maada Bio intensifies her Hands Off Our Girls campaign to combat gender-based violence. For more about the newly enacted law, I reach Mohamed Rahman Souare, Sierra Leone's Information Minister.
This is probably one of the biggest deals since the Civil War officially ended in 2002. Since the start of times, Sierra Leonean women have been clamoring for empowerment, they have been clamoring for freedom, they have been clamoring for rights, and many others. So this ascent today is historic in more ways than one. In fact, it comes fast on the heels of other reforms, frame-breaking reforms that have happened in this country under the leadership of President Julius Maada Bio. Before now, women had difficulties owning land in various parts of the country and even inheriting landed property. The Land Rights Bill has been enacted, which gives women the right to own this, to own property in any part of this country. Similarly, we have had a suite of other legislations, including this one today, the Gender Empowerment and Equality Bill.
How was their reaction, and what does this law now mean to the women in Sierra Leone?
Well, speaker after speaker recognized the fact that His Excellency has been revolutionary in his approach to women. They cited the historic declaration of rape as a national emergency, his enactment of the stiffest and strongest gender law to protect women and children, and also the setting up of the sexual offences model courts to expeditiously try suspects of gender-based violence. So all of these were cited, right, in a long continuum. The woman, speaker after speaker, noted that under his watch, His Excellency has done more than any other post-independence leader to bridge the gender equality gap, to empower women, and to ensure that women sit at the decision-making table together with their male counterparts. But the president, in his speech, stressed the fact that women constitute 52% of our population, and noted that that is quite a significant proportion of our population to live away from decision-making positions. So he insisted this is the right time, the long-awaited moment, you know, is finally here. The women chanted, freedom is finally here, freedom is here. You could see the hall literally erupting into the chorus of that music.
But what about private institutions in Sierra Leone? How will this be enforced?
This law was a product of wide-ranging consultations, including the private sector. In fact, representatives of the private sector did commit on behalf of their team that they will ensure that all the key and critical provisions of the bill are enforced, right? And even for organizations that are not in existence right now, once they come into existence, they will ensure that they bring them fully on board to ensure that provisions of the gender empowerment and equality be fully enforced to the benefit of women. Because once you have an enlightened and empowered female population, you have a progressive nation, right? So that was what each and every speaker noted. You know, members of the international community, the Irish ambassador, for example, who spoke on behalf of the diplomatic community, underscored His Excellency's very tenacious decision to empower women and pledge the support of the Irish embassy and the diplomatic community generally to supporting the enforcement of this bill every inch of the way. Because the bill is not only about empowering women who wish to run for public offices, it also creates opportunities for women generally to be able to access credit facilities without unattainable encumbrances. So this is very important because a large proportion of our women are into the informal sector. So they can now be able to access credit, you know, on very flexible terms.
The First Lady has been a very vociferous champion of women and gender empowerment and equality. What was her reaction after the president signed this into law?
Well, so speaker after speaker recognized her seminal role in the fight for women's equality, in the fight for women's empowerment, and more particularly for the Hands of Our Girls campaign, which she has now taken to the global stage. So glowing tributes were paid to her, and the husband himself, you know, recognized her very supportive role, her trailblazing role in ensuring that our girls and women around the country, you know, are safe and live in an enabling environment where they can realize their fullest potentials.
Mohamed Rahman Soare is Sierra Leone's Information Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown.
Direct from Washington, the voice of America, VOA.
In Nigeria, human rights activists and opposition groups are condemning the attack on Ikenga Ugochinyere, the spokesperson for the Opposition Coalition of United Political Parties, or CUPP. He's also a candidate for the main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, running for a federal seat on the House of Representatives from Imo State. The groups and the CUPP, as well as the main opposition PDP, are demanding an immediate investigation into the attack and increased protection for Ugochinyere. The assault was carried out by unknown gunmen at the home of Ugochinyere. Local media reports at least one person died during the attack and many were injured. The assailants reportedly burnt down the house and touched more than 40 vehicles. It comes as Nigerians express concern about politically related violence in the run-up to the coming February general election. For more reaction, I reach Mohamed Bassa. He is the national coordinator for the group called Civil Society Alliance for Transparency and Accountability.
It's rather unfortunate, and it's one too many, just like the many others that have come to be the norm in this country these days. It's really, really one too many. It is sad, and it is absolutely unacceptable. Ugochinyere has been one of the very strong voices in opposition who has spoken out against things that are not going right. And it is sad that this kind of incident will happen at his country home, considering the fact that he has always advocated for a better society where things like this do not happen. So there is the authorities have no excuse. They have no reason whatsoever not to be able to produce those who are responsible for this, and also to address the general slide in our society towards anarchy and lawlessness.
But why do you think there seem to be lawlessness, particularly in this area? Because some people are even suggesting that due to the insecurity in those areas, election might not necessarily even hold in those areas due to insecurity.
We really do need that independent investigation. But beyond that, there has to be a commitment from those who are in charge, from those who hold the mandate of the people to manage things like this. There has to be a firm commitment, and they in turn have to issue marching orders to the agencies that are responsible for enforcing security in the society to do their jobs. Because situations like this, where people go about in fear, where people go about not knowing if they are the next target or if they are the next victim, it's unacceptable, really. It's unacceptable. And certainly not in the 21st century.
There seem to be an increase in politically related violence in the run-up to next month's general election. Is this what you are seeing on the ground?
Well, naturally, when it's close to an election, and especially when it involves a public figure, or as we call them around here, a big man, there is definitely going to be a lot of publicity around it. And at this time, everything is going to be milked for political gain. But the bottom line is that this slide has happened over time. It has been there over time. Lots of people have been killed, many have been kidnapped, many have paid ransoms and got their loved ones back. Others paid ransoms, get their loved ones back. The bottom line is that this slide has been there over time. It's not just something that happened close to the election. No. Naturally, during elections, these things get more publicity. But the truth is, it's been there for quite a while now. And election or no election, the authorities just have to step in and stamp their foot. Because if it gets worse, we don't know, really.
Have the security agencies assured prospective voters of protection during the election process?
Well, we received conflicting signals from the Independent National Electoral Commission, the body responsible for conducting elections, because they, of course, liaise with the security agencies to ensure that the election holds. So if there are security reports like we had in 2015, when elections were postponed for about 6 weeks to enable the security agencies to deal with certain issues in the northeast of Nigeria. First, a director in the commission speaking in a public forum said elections might not hold, but the chairman of the commission came out to say, oh no, elections are going to hold. So we want to assume that the chairman is a superior authority and he is in touch with the security agencies, but they themselves have neither come out in word to tell us that these elections are going to hold, nor are we seeing it by their body language, by actions, by facts on the ground, because these things continue seemingly unabated.
Mohammed Bassa is the national coordinator for the group called Civil Society Alliance for Transparency and Accountability. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Still in Nigeria, young people running as candidates in the upcoming February 25 elections say the political environment in the West African nation is against them because it favors political parties and candidates with financial resources. Among the critics is Abdullahi Turaki, who is campaigning for the House of Representatives seat in Lokoja Kogi Federal Constituency. In an interview with my colleague Mike Hove, Turaki says the hostile setting made him join the opposition New Nigeria People's Party, despite his reservations about running for office.
Now, 4 years ago, I was working with the governor of Kogi State, and I never had the idea of running into party politics. I detest politics as a young person. I was like, no way, I'm not going to go into politics, not me. Mm-hmm. You know, I would never do it. I'd rather go and become a big businessman, come and help my people, you know, the little way I can. I had a lot of NGOs I was working with. I had my own personal NGO I set up. You know, it was called Book My School, and the idea was just to support schools to set up libraries. But along the way, I realized that in my society, Africa, Nigeria, the major, you know, institution that brings everything is the political institution. And we are not getting that result we want. We've allowed a certain set of people to just take it as their birthright. And we complain year in, year out. So if you want to actually get a different result, you need to go in and change the way it works. The result that is coming out can be different. So when I saw the Not Too Young to Run deal, I was so excited. And I had a good opportunity for young people. I was excited. I kept following up. I volunteered for some of the sessions. You know, supported even some of the logistics back in Kogi State to ensure that the team, you know, were readily available. And when it was passed, I was so happy. My friends came out and said, "This is our time." And I said, "Are you sure? We don't have money." Our friends, I said, "Let's get a party that can take us to the front line to be part of the race, because we don't want to get caught up with challenges of godfatherism, money politics. We just needed to be on that front runner. That alone will serve as a motivation to other people. Oh, how did they get to that, to be in the race?" And that is one of the questions I get every day. How did you get to be in the race, you know?
A lot of young voters say they want to vote in young people. They say they're tired of voting in elder leaders. However, as we've mentioned throughout this discussion, older leaders have both the political clout and the finances behind it. What do you plan on doing to A, receive the young voters, but also be able to follow up on your promises when you're within the system?
Thank you. So for my campaign plan, I have special focus for young people. So my campaign is focused on three thematic areas. We have education, economic growth, and the youth and leadership development. I have a project called Youth to Youth for AIT. So it's one youth talking to another youth to say, "Hey, there's a young person contesting, irrespective of your party, he's representing our demography, so we need to give him that support." For the ladies as well, we just set up a campaign called Girls in Politics, because in the traditional Nigerian setting, when you say women in politics, you look at older women, market women, and people that have become women leaders. Nobody is talking about that young lady in the university, 200 level, 300 level, that wants to get involved in good governance. Nobody's looking at that. The whole of last year, what we did was to come together and organize, you know, a little research to know what exactly do the people want. So we've gone to them and said, "What exactly do you want from me as a legislator, under my capacity as a legislator?" We've gathered all of that to form a development plan for the people. You know, it is under a framework called LEAP, Legislative Empowerment and Employment Program.
Abdullahi Turaki is a House of Representatives candidate. He spoke with my colleague, Mike Hove. In Malawi, the justice minister says he is pleased with President Lazarus Chakwera's fight against graft and mismanagement, but also adds that there is room for improvement. The remarks by Titus Mvalu come after the president replaced the director for public prosecution following a sharp disagreement with the director of the Anti-Corruption Bureau. For more on the fight against fraud in Malawi, I read Justice Minister Titus Mvalu.
The fight against corruption has never been as intense as it is now ever in this country. When we came into government in July 2020, the country was burning with corruption. And one of the reasons why the previous government lost power was because of corruption. And we said, if we come into government, we're going to eradicate corruption. Now, so far, we have done a lot of things to show our commitment to fight against corruption in this country. Previously, the Anti-Corruption Bureau, which is the institution mandated here to deal with matters of corruption, had been starved without funding. The funding was not being provided, and that was a deliberate move to incapacitate Anti-Corruption Bureau, in short, ACB. When we came in, we made sure that all funds that had been denied of them, and we made sure that that was given to them immediately. We increased their budget from 4 billion kwacha to over 6 billion kwacha, which was more than 50% increase And then we also have been funding, not just in the budget, but we've also been, obviously, with our cooperating partners, I've also been helping SCB to get more funding. And recently, we also even have funded SCB further with another extra 500 million kwacha, just for them to increase their capacity of prosecution.
Are you saying that there's a political will from the president right down to institutions that fight against corruption, that there's a political will and the president is putting the resources where his mouth is to root out corruption in Malawi?
There's the strongest political will we've ever had in this country, from the president himself, right down the line. The political will is unquestionable. It is firm and obvious. And the money has been put, is still being put where it should go to help fight corruption. So what I can assure you as Minister of Justice, that because SCB is an institution which, although by law is said to be independent, but it still falls under a line ministry. It falls under my ministry. So I am directly conscious and aware of what is going on at SCB. And the president also is aware, because SCB reports to the president and to the Minister of Justice. So we are both very, very aware, and we're very keen to make sure that SCB works, and not just SCB, because fighting corruption is not just one institution fight. They lead in the fight, but there are also many other players in the fight.
Do these institutions that fight against corruption, including the Anti-Corruption Bureau, have the confidence of, one, the president, and two, you, in their act or in their effort to fight corruption in Malawi?
These institutions have complete confidence in the president and in me as the Minister of Justice, and in the system, including the judiciary. Because once one is arrested and prosecuted, prosecution takes place in a court. And the courts, too, have just created a special court called Financial Crimes Court to make sure that matters to do with financial crimes like corruption are dealt with expeditiously and efficiently.
Are you pleased with the direction of the fight against corruption in Malawi?
So I'm very pleased. We could do better, and I think we'll do better. Where we've seen that there's been a weakness has been in the collaboration between the law enforcement agencies, like the police working hand in hand with SCB, the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions, all these which are in law financial intelligence agency, all these institutions need to work in collaboration in terms of investigation, exchange of information and evidence. We need now to bring them together and work together more efficiently. And that way, we think we're going to strengthen the fight against corruption.
The president has removed the DPP and replaced him with somebody else. Now, what informed the president's choice? Because the people are saying the president should have also gotten rid of the head of the Anti-Corruption Bureau if indeed he decides to get rid of the DPP or replace the DPP. What's your reaction to that?
No, I think, you see, what the president received were recommendations from the commission of inquiry, which was set up to inquire into the unfortunate arrest of the director of the SCB. So the president, a recommendation as it is a recommendation. Once something is recommended to somebody, like to the president, he is free to take it all or to do something different. In this case, the recommendation was that he should change leadership, both at the SCB and at the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions. He has, in his discretion, decided to change leadership in the Office of the DPP and leave the leadership of SCB intact. I think he wants to see how it will pan out, how it will work, giving another chance to see how she perform with the new DPP. I think it's the right decision to make. Because sometimes you don't want to change leadership in such high-profile cases, offices at the same time. I mean, if you change leadership in both offices at the same time, you could have a problem of capacity as well, because people who come would be new in both offices.
Titus Mvalo is Malawi's justice minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Meanwhile, Malawi's president, Lazarus Chakwera, has replaced the director of public prosecution, Stephen William Kayuni. In a speech broadcast on national television, the president denounced his alleged abuse of office and subsequently replaced him with Masauko Edwin Chamkakala as the new director of public prosecution. Some anti-graft campaigners hail the move as an important action that could boost the fight against corruption. But critics say the president did not go far enough, adding that he should have also fired the director of the Anti-Corruption Bureau, Martha Chizuma. For analysis and the latest development, I reach human rights and governance expert Undole Mwakasungula.
Every Malawian, including myself, have welcomed the firing of the director for public prosecution, the DPP, because I think there have been some working relation problems between the DPP and the anti-corruption director, including the entire anti-corruption bureau, in how they could deal with issues of corruption, especially cases. So this, I think, has been, that has pleased all Malawians, actually, that the president decided to relieve the position of the director for public prosecutions. And I believe that the new guy who is coming in to take over, the new DPP, will bring some sanity in terms of relationship between the DPP office, but also the Anti-Corruption Bureau, so that there's smooth facilitation of cases related to corruption in Malawi.
Now, the president expressed concern that he will not stand while people use their offices to intimidate or bully others. But is this what the previous DPP, Dr. Stephen William Kayuni, did, for which reason the president decided to kick him out?
And I think there have been some personal clashes between the two offices as individuals, the Anti-Corruption Bureau, a director, but also the DPP himself. There have been some personal issues, personal egos, and this, I think, affected the entire fight against corruption. That's why I could see the Anti-Corruption Bureau having problems in terms of seeking consent from the DPP. So I think there have been some personal issues which affected the operation and professionalism of the Anti-Corruption Bureau, but also the entire fight of the corruption in Malawi. So I think it was right for the president to mention that, because it was visible, it was seen, everybody saw that there was individual personal fights, personal issues between the two individuals, especially the DPP and the Anti-Corruption Bureau director.
Some people are suggesting that perhaps the president did not go far enough, and that there is a recommendation that even the director of public prosecution, Martha Chizuma, should be relieved of her duties and replaced. What is your take on that?
I will have some reservation on that one, because that one would have brought a lot of anger from Malawians. I don't think Martha Chizuma issues right now would have even made the president to relieve her the responsibility as Anti-Corruption Bureau director. But I think most Malawians feel that she's doing the right job, actually, in terms of fighting corruption. What she needs, what the government and the president need to do, is to give her more support and more resources. And there are issues which maybe need to be looked into, which the president also mentioned actually, the lack of cooperation between the inter-government agencies, actually, all who are fighting, who are responsible for fighting corruption. And this is an area which also need to be looked into, because one of the issues which came out, actually, which also maybe might have been the factor, was the lack of working or collaboration between the two inter-government agencies. And this also affected and is affecting still the operation of the Anti-Corruption Bureau, actually, and the director herself. So to me, firing the director would have created a lot of anger and would have maybe made the president look as if he's not serious in terms of fighting corruption in this country.
And do you think the director of public prosecution has the political will from the president and support from the president that will enable her to carry out her duties in the fight against corruption without fear or favor.
Yeah, but what is interesting, I mean, honestly, these are constitutional bodies, you know, they are independent. We assume they are independent. And if they are independent, that means they are detached from any political influence. But, you know, the challenge is the appointing officer is the president. So that's where the danger part of it. So we believe that the new director, for public prosecutions will be as independent as possible, but also not being influenced by the executive or the president or any other forces or sectors or society. So this is our belief, and this is our hope, and this is our prayer, that the DPP should be independent, work independently, and support the efforts of fighting corruption in Malawi by working closely with the Anti-Corruption Bureau Director and the entire Anti-Corruption Bureau office.
Ondule Mwakasungula is human rights and governance expert. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Tutu Alicante, the executive director of the non-governmental organization called Equatorial Guinea Justice, says the arrest of a son of the president of the country is not likely to boost the fight against corruption. He says it appears the arrest aims to prop up and sanitize the image of Vice President Teodoro Ngema Obiang Mange to the international community as part of the plan to take over from his father, President Teodoro Obiang Nguema Mbazoko. His remarks come after the vice president ordered the arrest of his half-brother, Ruslan Obiang Nsu, for allegedly selling an aircraft and pocketing the proceeds. But Tutu Alicante tells me he is not impressed with what he described as a mere public relations exercise to boost the vice president's international image as a corruption fighter.
We should understand this as a charade. This is part of the tragic comedy that Equatorial Guinea has become. And I say it's a tragic comedy because it's tragic for the people of Equatorial Guinea who are living in poverty despite the amount of wealth that this country has. However, it is a comedy because this is just a charade.
Why is this a charade?
This is because, you know, what we're looking at, you know, is a fox in charge of the hen house, right? Teodorin is convicted in France. A sentence that has been upheld by the highest court in France, the Cour de Cassation, for embezzlement and money laundering. Teodorin has his assets, multi-million dollar assets, seized in the U.S., in Switzerland, in Brazil, in Cape Town, South Africa. Yet he is in charge of combating corruption in Equatorial Guinea. What does this tell you? That this is just a game for Teodorin to place himself as the next president, as the successor of his father. This is all this is, you know. Mr. Ruslan, the half-brother, is at home, right? This is a house arrest. He is enjoying a life of luxury. So this is just a game. This is just a game for the IMF and the U.S. and others to think that Teodorin is interested in combating corruption. That's it.
But some people are suggesting that this is a positive development for Equatorial Guinea, that at least somebody is being held accountable for something that he did.
So there is no doubt that Ruslan has pocketed the proceeds from that sale. And there is absolutely no doubt that Teodorin is pocketing hundreds of millions of dollars every single day, right? So is it a positive development? No, because this is just a charade. You know, you have many other ministers, dozens of ministers and their kids, stealing every single day in Equatorial Guinea, right? If you are going to go after corruption, you have to start from the top, right? As we say in my country, say that the fish starts rotting from the head, right? So if you're going to fix a fish, if you're going to fix Equatorial Guinea, you have to start from Teodorin, his father, his mother, who owned the biggest company in Equatorial Guinea. What does it tell you when the presidential family is the richest family in the country.
Some people are saying that Teodorin only acted following an independent and thorough investigation into the aircraft that allegedly disappeared while undergoing maintenance in Spain. So all he did was to follow due process and to ensure that an investigation, a proper investigation is done, the culprit is held accountable, and that should be a worthwhile development. Your take?
I want to live in an Equatorial Guinea where due process is ensured by the courts, by the judicial system, not by the vice president, who is vice president only because his father wants him to be. Teodorin has assumed not just all the powers of the judiciary in Equatorial Guinea. Any civilian today in Equatorial Guinea that has a problem, the first thing they think, I need to see Teodorin. And that is not a democratic country. That is not a country that upholds the rule of law. Quite the contrary. To the extent that you are relying on someone like Teodorin, that is the rule of man, the rule of a human, not the rule of law, right? And that is the problem in Equatorial Guinea. And that only breeds corruption. That does not fix a single problem in Equatorial Guinea.
What do you say to supporters of the Teodorin and perhaps the government who say that some of you are being unpatriotic? You sit in Western nations or wealthier nations to criticize everything that is going on instead of even looking at the positive side of some developments that have happened in Equatorial Guinea. You just wash Equatorial Guineans, so to speak, dirty linen in public incessantly. How do you respond to that?
What I say, you know, is democracy has to involve a healthy disagreement, right? That is democracy. You have to have multiple opinions. We live in the U.S. and you have several parties and you have news media and you have the Voice of America, and everybody can voice their opinion. And this is not only in America. You go to Kenya, you go to Ghana, you go to Nigeria, and you have journalists, you have people voicing different opinions. You have political parties vying to reach out, reach people with a different message, right? That is what we want in Equatorial Guinea. If anyone thinks that what we have in Equatorial Guinea today, with Teodorin and his father governing that country for 5 decades, is what they want, well, I have to tell them, you know, look, you've got the country that you want. For most Equatorial Guineans, we want a country in which my sister does not have to die at the hospital because there's no electricity, in one of Africa's wealthiest countries, in one of our GDP per capita wise, right? I want a country in which my nieces and nephews can go to school, and that is not the country they will have today in Equatorial Guinea.
Tutu Alicante is the executive director of the non-governmental organization called Equatorial Guinea Justice. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Uganda, art teachers are calling on the government to increase their salaries by 100% this year. If it fails to do so, they say they will embark on a strike until their demand is met. The teachers criticize the government's decision to only increase the salaries of science teachers, creating what they say is tension, low morale, and divisions among other instructors. In a letter to the Minister of Education, the teachers also call the move a double standard. They demand the government keep its promise to increase their salaries this year. For more on the situation, I reach Philbert Baguma. He is the Secretary General of the Uganda National Teachers Union, or UNATU.
You recall last year, we still had the same issue about the salary enhancement of teachers, where the government divided the teachers alongside sciences and arts. And they left out the teachers of arts and humanities in post-primary and then the primary school teachers. This has not gone well in the teaching learning process, whereby the teachers of primary and the teachers of arts and humanities are not feeling part of the teaching profession and therefore cannot deliver the quality of education that is expected of them. And that's why we have again wrote to remind government about its obligation, if they still have education as one of their priority areas, then we must see government coming up to enhance the for all teachers across the board.
But Philbert, some people are saying this is coming at a time where the president himself has said that the government doesn't have money, it needs to save money, and is even calling on civil servants as well as members of parliament not to travel overseas. He has imposed a ban. So the timing of this call is not appropriate. How do you respond to that?
I don't know when we have ever had government saying they have enough money, or even at individual level when someone comes up to say, at least now I have enough money. And therefore, the little money that is there must be used fairly and equitably amongst Ugandans. We are not looking at money per se. The country has never had enough money. Over years, we see government going to borrow, an indication that they do not have enough money. And therefore, the story is not different. But what we are saying is, if we have to see the learning process go on, then we have to address the anomaly.
Some people are saying that the organizations threat to embark on a sit-down strike or an industrial strike action to pressure the government to do your bidding is unfortunate because you are not seeking to negotiate in good faith. Right? So the government should even ignore and perhaps even fire at teachers and hire new ones.
Whoever says that has stopped reasoning and thinking. We have written a reminder to government. We have not pronounced an industrial action. And therefore, whoever talks like he is himself out of order and doesn't know what she is saying and should go back to study so that they can be able to comprehend whatever is written.
Is your organization sticking by its demands that if the government fails to increase salaries of teachers by 100% demanded by the union, you will embark on that strike?
Obviously, and I am telling you that delaying to solve the teacher issue is postponing the teaching learning process. And that is obvious. So the government has a choice either to make a postponement of the teaching learning process and the people go to class and pretend to be teaching when they are not, or solve the issue and the teachers go to class and concentrate on teaching.
When do you want the government to act to pay these teachers? And when do you plan on engaging the government in this negotiation as the government prepares to release its budget for the year?
The government is now in the budgeting process, and therefore we expect them to take note and address the issue. If they don't, then we shall follow the due process and go on as the law provides.
Philbert Baguma is the Secretary General of the Uganda National Teachers Union, or UNATU. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala.
Direct from Washington, the voice of
the human rights group Refugees International says climate change is fueling conflict and migration in the Lake Chad Basin and is calling on the issue to be addressed on an international conference on the region next week in Niamey. The group says drought, flooding, and the shrinking of Lake Chad has contributed to the displacement of 3 million people and left 11 million people in need of assistance. According to the Associated Press, a report by Refugees International says that climate change has led to fighting over natural resources in places such as Le Gourne-Birni commune in northern Cameroon, where 60,000 people have sought refuge in Chad. The UN says irrigation, the construction of dams, and population increases are also contributing to the crisis. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Trust me.
she want to corner my location. She want to germinate on top of this my plantation. And if I answer, she go carry me go for vacation. She want to get down, but she know no say me a big gladiator. Mama, the girl a down galanty, body down balance, ready to fire keko. Mama, I know the two shot and come up, mama, me a fi carry your galley keko. Mama, mama, I dare make I dare. I know they want to do like say, me a supposed to go holiday, but I want to stay.
Capi future.
From the continent, and we hope you enjoy. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mike Harvey, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, do not allow the belly to make you useless. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.